Hello there, this is Richard Alabone on webtalkradio.net, talking this week about mental illness, which is something not normally considered as paranormal. But it's very much related to trance and possibly telepathy, and is just as difficult to understand as ghosts or spirits. Of course, it's all too common, causing much misery to those unfortunate people who have it. My guest is an extremely experienced and knowledgeable therapist in that area. Joe Griffin is his name, and he has a wonderful Irish accent coming from Dublin in the Republic of Ireland. His main message that he gives to distressed people is that there is light at the end of the tunnel. Clinical depression is a passing phase, he says, and that the mental state that causes it can be reversed. Generally speaking, pills only mask the problem and don't help. Joe talks about the reason for depression, panic attacks and phobias, saying that faulty dreaming and trance during the day are the root cause. He points out that guided imagery during hypnosis is the best way that these unwanted, unconscious thoughts can be changed and understood. So let me introduce to you Joe Griffin.
Hello, Joe.
Oh, hi, Richard.
Hello. At long last, we've got...
I must admit I was a little despairing when I rang the number this morning and found it didn't work. So we're all sorted. Yeah.
So I have a talk about mental health issues and trance, which, of course, is something which has been your life, really, hasn't it?
It has indeed been the major part of my professional life, for sure.
Now, I see that Human Givens College, which I believe is what you call the college now, lectures on about 16 different topics. I was surprised how many there are, how many issues in mental health. So perhaps we could go through one or two of those. And I believe you personally lecture on depression, which, of course, is perhaps the number one thing about trance.
I do personally lecture on depression and a number of other subjects as well. But you're right, Richard. Depression is the number one emotional distress problem in our country today and in the Western world, for that matter, closely followed by anxiety. And, of course, there's a huge connection between depression and trance, which is the area you're interested in. To understand that connection, the connection basically is this, is that when we're depressed, we wake up shattered and exhausted. We know that depressed people dream excessively and have insufficient of deeply recuperative slow-wave sleep. That's been known since the mid-1960s. However, what was not known was, why is it depressed people wake up exhausted and have too much dreaming? That wasn't known. And we now have the answer to that. And it comes down to this, that dreaming exists in order to eliminate emotional arousals from the previous day that have not been acted out. And that's a housekeeping function. But when people are distressed and anxious and worried about things, that causes excessive dreaming, which leads to brain exhaustion, which leads to depression. And so there's a very close connection between dreaming and clinical depression. There's a very close connection between dreaming and trance states, because the dream state evolved originally to program instincts in the womb. And when we get a person into trance today, what we're doing is we're accessing that programming state. It's used at nighttime for dreaming, but it's also accessible whilst we're awake via guided imagery and other hypnotic processes. And since it's the programming state, if you like, that has been overworked in order to trigger clinical depression, it turns out that this trance state, this programming state, is our single most powerful intervention for clinical depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I sort of see it as depression gets deep into, or the ideas of depression and feelings and get deep into the unconscious, and that's why it's so difficult to put things right.
We know that depressed people have a pervasive sense of hopelessness, that they are basically in despair about the prospect of them being able to sort their lives out and to be able to have a future that's worthwhile. And that despair exists not just at a cognitive level, but at a deep emotional level within their brain. And the first thing that has to happen is the brain's energy systems have to be brought back into balance by correcting the sleep pattern. If we get the dreaming back to normal levels, then the brain gets re-energized. They can think more coherently, and then it's possible to start tackling the issues. With obsessive compulsive disorder, what we find there is that there's a brain system not operating correctly. What you find is that there is a circuit in the brain going from the emotional brain up to the cognitive mind that's hyperactive, and it's triggered again by stress. And in many ways, it has some overlap with addictions, because the person has to be taught how to withdraw attention from those fears and refocus their attention in positive ways in the environment. Now, again, the trance state can very much help with that refocusing of attention and de-escalating their perception of threat. To our way of thinking, and we've done over 3,000 assessments of patients treated by these methods according to objective criteria, and part of this research has been published by the British Psychological Society. We find that the wide range of sort of clinical problems that we'll encounter at a primary health level, we have treated now over 3,000 patients and assessed them before and afterwards. And what we find is that these types of methods can successfully treat 3 out of 4 patients in a handful of sessions. So trance as a tool for psychotherapy is the single most powerful tool in the armory of any psychotherapist, beyond a shadow of doubt.
My own view of trance is that it's a system whereby consciousness is automatically reduced when it starts off with instinctive thoughts. When instinctive thoughts comes into the mind, then consciousness is subdued on that particular topic, and so the instinctive action is carried out. Whereas where it's something which is not instinctive, something like a phobia, then it acts in the same way, in that when it appears into brain and mind, it reduces consciousness. And that's the way I look at it. I know it's not quite the same way that...
I would absolutely empathize with that formulation, Richard. I would absolutely empathize. I definitely see trance state as a narrowing and a focusing of attention, that it evolved for the expression of instincts, and that nowadays it can also be pathologically activated. Well, I would totally agree with your analysis there.
Yes, I think it's the same system as the instinctive system, whereby instinctive actions are carried out, and it then unfortunately happens, the same system works for non-instinctive things, like, as I say, phobias or just sheer depression. When it surfaces, then the conscious mind just switches off. And
absolutely.
There's little that the individual can do about it.
And they're operating mechanically, for sure.
Yeah. I was a mechanical engineer, so I look at these things in a mechanical way, you know.
I think it's a very helpful approach, yes. Because at a certain level, the brain is a mechanical system. It's more complex than that, of course, but it is at a certain level a mechanical system, and it certainly is a useful metaphor very often for getting at things. The reason why, of course, human beings are so vulnerable to mental illness is that the human species, more than any other species on the planet, its instincts aren't fully programmed. Their instincts are only partially programmed from the genetic inheritance, and they're partially completed then through environmental learning. And the rule of thumb for human beings is that human behavior is on balance 50% genetic and 50% learned. Now, because there's a learning component to the operation of instincts, if that learning goes awry, then the instincts don't operate awry, and we are in maladaptive trance states. So, for example, in a phobia, the learning that spiders and cats are life-threatening animals is wrong. Whereas if that learning had been applied to tigers in Africa, say, in the time of our ancestors, it would have been a total appropriate expression of that fear. The faulty learning that's allying itself to instincts that create, in my view, these problems.
Yeah, and because of the particular way that human minds work rather than the rest of the animal kingdom, that is the reason that we have mental problems.
Yes. Our other vulnerability arises from the very gift that we have of consciousness and conscious thinking and introspecting, that if we use our imagination simply to get trapped in worry cycles, then that will cause enormous pressure on the autonomic nervous system and emotional arousal, leading to sleep imbalance, leading to all kinds of mental illnesses. In an extreme form, of course, the trance state going awry is that we get psychotic illnesses where people can't actually distinguish waking reality from dream reality. It's perfectly normal for a sane person to hear voices in their dreams. It's perfectly normal for a sane person to see people who are not there and things that are not there in their dreams. But if we overstress this dream mechanism, what we find is that dream phenomena start appearing whilst people are awake and they can't distinguish what's real from what's dream phenomena, and then they're deemed to be in a psychotic state. But again, this is always caused by emotional needs not being met, excessive worry and distress and worrying about it, unbalancing this instinctive trance mechanism.
Well, one aspect of this that I don't understand is panic attacks.
We find that we get tremendous success with working with panic attacks. Again, the panic attacks arise because some emotional need is threatened, whether it's the collapse of a relationship, whether it is financial pressures, whether it is bullying at work and insecurity at work. But they're arising because emotional needs are not being met. Now, everybody has vulnerabilities because human beings are a very complex organizational system. And in any complex system, there are points of vulnerability, and they differ from individual to individual. But for some individuals, when they're under a lot of stress, panic attacks get triggered off. Panic attacks are simply the body's alarm reaction gone awry. But it is an exaggeration. It starts out with the activation of the body's fight or flight mechanism. And then that mechanism is further intensified by breathing in too much oxygen and not taking the action to burn it up. And that causes the further symptoms of distress that are experienced. So panic attacks are fairly easily treatable, Richard. Firstly, the person has to learn how to do diaphragmatic breathing to be able to bring the oxygen carbon dioxide levels back into balance in the blood. And then one has to pragmatically and realistically address the sources of fear, sources of stress that are causing this in the first place. Guided imagery, again, or trance states, we find very useful here, because once you get the person relaxed and in a trance state, you can explain to them what a panic attack is. It's the body's alarm reaction going off inappropriately. And because they're responding to this with such distress, they are exacerbating the physiological symptoms connected to that. And by giving them that reassurance in trance, by calming them down, and then perhaps using guided imagery to see themselves realistically tackling what problems they have, people very quickly get a handle on the panic attacks, Richard.
Yeah, and just some little thing will trigger it off, and then the person concerned has very little way normally of doing anything about it. It just gets worse and worse, and they get in a terrible state.
They get trapped in the cycle,
Yes.
In more extreme cases, people will end up being trapped in their homes, and the panic attacks metamorph into agoraphobia, where a person is terrified of leaving their own home unless they've got somebody with them for protection. And again, that instinct, you know, of being fearful of leaving your own home, of wanting somebody with you in the outside world, those are natural instincts, because human beings as a species, we don't have any natural defense mechanism like huge talons that can rip an animal's innards out, or jaws that are really powerful and that can kill an animal. Our natural defense mechanisms, when we're frightened, are to bunch together and try and defend ourselves as a group, or to run away and hide in our cave. And in a condition like agoraphobia, where the person is afraid to leave their house unless they've got somebody with them and wants to spend as much time as possible in their house, they are experiencing the natural instincts that belong to the human species when we feel frightened of the outside environment. So the problem is not those feelings. The problem is to help the person to realize that the outside environment is not the threat that they are emotionally perceiving it to be. And again, guided imagery is very helpful in that process, or trance work and rehearsal and teaching the person how to keep control over their breathing mechanism as they progressively re-engage with the environment and get back their confidence in moving about in their environment again.
And the guided imagery is just sort of reprogramming the unconscious,
exactly
the deep part of the mind. Yeah,
exactly that, Richard. Yeah. Exactly that.
So you see, guided imagery under hypnosis is one of the main things that can beat mental illness. But in this section, I'm going to discuss the relationship between paranormal experiences and depression, with all the associated problems that people have. As Joe said, the feeling of not wanting to leave your home is a very natural instinct, just as the fear of spiders is a natural instinct. But we know that instincts come to mind out of the blue, as it were. Just the sight of a spider for some people makes them pull away in fear. They are unable to think rationally about whether the spider is dangerous or not. And in just the same way, the mere thought of going out into the street with people and cars strikes fear into some people. It's the same mechanism as the fear of spiders causing the fight and flight response. A person with agoraphobia is unable to think rationally about the dangers of going outside or into a crowded room. It's the same instinctive mechanism that subdues consciousness. And all mental illness is due to wrong thinking, getting into the unconscious brain, which then repeatedly surfaces into conscious mind, where the trance system inhibits conscious reasoning. It's such a simple and obvious explanation for an immense amount of misery. But this explanation for what trance is and what it does to us is not generally appreciated. Not only is it the explanation for many paranormal experiences, but I'm sure it is the explanation for mental misery. I'm also sure that if this mechanism were explained to sufferers with a mental problem, so that they could understand why they have a repeating phobia or panic attack or flashback, then they might avoid the fear which is part of the problem. The thing that really fascinates me about all this is that mental illness is so similar to many experiences called paranormal. In fact, it really is just the same, with the same root cause. It is the instinctive mechanism that we are all born with that sometimes goes wrong, which puts mental illness in the same category as the paranormal. But unfortunately, it's all too normal. We know that the best way of accessing the unconscious mind is by hypnosis, plus the right suggestions, what Joe refers to as guided imagery. This is the way that many wrong messages that have found their way into unconsciousness can be neutralized. So now I'd like to ask Joe about more problems that the Human Givens College lecture about. How about relationship problems and self-harming, Joe?
Well, relationship problems arise when there's a failure to have mutual emotional needs satisfaction. When we're in a relationship, I need intimacy from my partner. I need emotional support from my partner. I need my partner to be protective of my status, to allow me to have controls, a degree of control in decision-making, etc. And if the emotional needs are not being met in the relationship, the mutual emotional needs are not being met, the relationship will break down. Of course, some of the time what actually happens is it's the outside environment that's causing the stressors, and the person is feeling unhappy, and then they're looking inward for the answers and seeing the problems as being caused by their partner, when in fact the problems may be caused by pressures at work. The self-harming is a very interesting thing that you mentioned, Richard, in that self-harming appears to be on the increase, as all addictions appear to be at this time in our culture. And self-harming has overlaps with addictive behaviors. But basically, self-harming arises because the person is in emotional distress. They're either feeling disappointed in themselves and hating themselves, or they're in such emotional distress that a way of distracting themselves and getting attention perhaps as well is to self-harm. But again, it's an eminently treatable problem once one looks at the causes, what lies behind the self-harm. Self-harm really is a strategy for reducing emotional pain. And once we can target the sources of the emotional pain and deal with it, then that strategy is no longer needed by the patient.
Yes, of course, I guess a lot of self-harming comes back to the big problem of depression.
Yes, and one of the things that's so important to get across to depressed people, that depression is a temporary state, that you can get out of it. You are not seeing reality objectively whilst you're depressed. The situation seems much more hopeless than it actually is in reality, because the high emotional arousal is impeding the functioning of your cortex and your thinking mechanism, and you're perceiving reality inevitably in black and white terms that really are not giving you an accurate view of your situation or your future prospects. And again, trance work really helps the person see the bigger picture and see things more in context, and have hope for the future. Because that's the most important thing. Indeed, I say to people, if you're thinking of referring somebody to a counsellor for depression, this is the question you should ask of the counsellor. What do you do to build hope of recovery in your patients from the very first session? Because if the counsellor doesn't know that that's the single most important job in the first session, then the patient may be dead by the next session, by the time the next session comes around. Because the reason why people kill themselves is not because of pain. It is because they are convinced the pain will never end. Yeah. So the first job of a counsellor is to get across to the patient, your depression is temporary. You can get out of it. And that way you have to work on that from the very first session.
Yeah, and the guided imagery is the way that...
It's one of the most powerful ways, Richard, because whilst you can cognitively give people information when they're depressed, it doesn't mean an awful lot. Whereas if you can do guided imagery and get a depressed patient deeply relaxed, because depressed people are hugely tensed up inside themselves, and with the guided imagery, you get them deeply relaxed and get them back in touch with past patterns of success and sowing the seeds of hopefulness about the future. That is so powerful in lifting depression.
Yeah. Now, as one particular, my interest, as you know, is all the paranormal. And one big aspect of that, of course, is telepathy. Now, I know that people in the medical profession are very reluctant to admit that there is such a thing as telepathy. But I see that in some of your writings, you've spoken about telepathy and ESP and this sort of thing, and telepathic dreaming. I wondered if, to what extent you think that telepathy is a factor sometimes in producing stressful situations. I mean, paranoia is, from the medical point of view, they don't mention the word telepathy. I view paranoia as something which is mainly telepathic, whereas people think that people are looking at them or having bad thoughts about them, which in fact they receive telepathically. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, that is a completely new theory to me, Richard. I've never heard that theory before. But let me say that I absolutely accept that telepathy exists, and it's a common part of our waking lives. And I find it hard to understand how anybody who is emotionally aware cannot be aware of the role of telepathy in our day-to-day lives. Apart from that, of course, there is abundant, strong scientific evidence now to show that telepathy exists. So I don't think that any person with an open mind who looks at the evidence can really, really have a strong view that telepathy doesn't exist. I think that must come from an ideological basis. But the idea that telepathy could be the basis of paranoia is a completely new idea to me. And I'd really have to think about that. It's an intriguing idea, Richard, and I would certainly give it thought.
Well, I'm a firm believer that that is the case.
Yeah.
Because
have you had success using that as the basis for treating paranoia?
No, not really. I speak just from personal experience. One time I was having a bad time at work. I was a development engineer, and I was ostracized by the people in the section. That produced a very strange feeling in myself, which I regarded as slight paranoia. And I'm quite convinced that it came about because of telepathy, subconsciously realizing what the other people were thinking and saying. But so that was how come I got to that idea. But looking at a little bit of the literature on paranoia, it does seem to tie up. So I wondered if you people had realized that this may be. But as you say, it's quite new to you. I'm a little
surprised
about that.
It's completely new.
You'll have to think about that one.
I will indeed, Richard. I will indeed have to think about that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now perhaps you'd like to tell me and listeners a little. You were originally Minefield College, and that's changed now to Human Givens College, is that?
Yes, we were originally taught Human Givens through Minefield College. Minefield College was set up. I mean, I wasn't a shareholder in it. It was set up about 20 years ago and taught about 200,000 people came to lectures and seminars. The Human Givens Institute ran a great many of its courses through Minefield College. But about 3 years ago, government cutbacks for contracts meant that Minefield College was advised it had to go into liquidation. But in a way, it's been a hugely positive thing, because Human Givens College, which is what our therapy has evolved over 20 years to become, we can now actually call the college what it really is, Human Givens College and the Human Givens approach. And we're very positive and hopeful that this has a role to play in society, in education, and an increasing role to play in therapy.
Yeah. Yes,
we've just recently, by the way, published a new book, further completing the Human Givens paradigm, which we've actually called Godhead, the brain's big bang. And what this book does is it sets out to explore the origins of creativity, mysticism, and mental illness, and provide a synthesis of how we can make sense of consciousness and our place in the universe today.
Yes, I have. In fact, I have a copy of Human Givens' book myself. But I didn't know about the latest book.
The Godhead book. We really see that the Human Givens as being part one, and the Godhead book as being part two, completing, as it were, the ideas that their natural, organic unfoldment, as it were.
Okay, and there's various websites, of course.
Well, they're all available from Amazon. Human Givens Institute, again, if you just type in Human Givens Institute, you'll get our website and details of all our courses and workshops in literature.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for all that. I'm sure there's a lot there that my listeners will be interested in, the relationship between trance and something which is unfortunately much too normal, that is mental problems. Too much of it, unfortunately.
Indeed. Okay. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Richard.
Yes, well,
thank you very much.
Say goodbye.
My guest today gave us a great deal of inside information about the range of mental problems, and there are many more that Joan didn't get round to talking about. The lectures that have been given in the major cities in the UK have been attended by 200,000 people, which is most impressive. Do have a look at the website to see the 20 different one-day courses that they do, and presented they are by only 9 lecturers, with Joe doing more than half of them. I have to say I was pleased to hear his response to my question about whether telepathy plays a part in causing mental stress. Too many respected scientists have no time for the ridiculous notion of telepathy, but Joe's reaction was quite the opposite. I hope that today's show has again made the point that the paranormal things in life are in fact quite normal. A great big thank you to my guest, Joe Griffin, for spending his time to talk to us, which I hope you found to be of interest. This is Richard Allibone signing off from webtalkradio.net. Bye for now.